White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew. Welcome to episode 61 of our reading of Henry Ford's great investigation into how Jews gained decisive control in the modern world, especially in America. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Hadding Scott.
Now, Hadding, last week you read chapter 55 about a certain Mr. Leo N. Levi of Texas. Yeah. Who was also a B'nai B'rith president in his last years, who was seeking to be fair about the Jewish question. Well, he told the truth about a lot of things, and I liked last week's chapter very much, as I have liked all the chapters so far, and I say so. But this chapter 56 is the first one I do not like. It is about another Jew with a similar name. This is Dr. Oscar Levy, L-E-V-Y, who is presented as also critical and fair-minded about the Jews, but I don't quite see it that way. He seems like a shyster to me. What is your opinion?
Well, this Oscar Levy made a big name for himself, maybe among other things, by translating Nietzsche from German into English. From the perspective of Jews, that's kind of an ambiguous thing because, you know, Nietzsche went through a period where he was saying a lot of nice things about Jews. So it kind of looks a bit self-serving. And some of the comments that he makes in this strike me as being sort of indirect Jewish boasting.
Exactly. Exactly. And it just goes on and on. Till finally, towards the end, I was just fed up with this man. And I thought, why do we have this chapter in here?
Okay, everybody can turn off the computer now.
Yeah. No, but I mean, that's what I thought, but I'm not too worried about it. People will still want to hear what he has to say. But he admits his people's errors. But after he praises his people, it seems to me, praises them to the skies, and he kind of still makes Jews out to be the saviors of Europe, and that in the sense that we can't get along without them, even though then he goes along with
I think he gives Jews too much credit.
Absolutely.
He puts blame on them, but it seems so much blame that it amounts to exaggerating their importance.
Exactly. That's what he does. He exaggerates the importance, and I think it's on purpose. I can't see that it's just, he just inadvertently turns out that way. So, well, we'll read it, and we'll let the listeners decide.
All right.
This should be quite interesting, actually.
All right.
So, you go ahead.
International Jew, Chapter 56.
And the title.
Yes. We got. Yeah, I almost forgot to read the title. Yes, very good. Thank you.
All right.
Dr. Levy, a Jew, admits his people's error.
All right.
A Jew of standing, Dr. Oscar Levy, well known in English literary circles and a lover of his people. Oh, boy. Has had the honesty and the wisdom to meet the Jewish question with truth and candor, if you call that candor. His remarks are printed in this article as an example of the methods by which Jewry can be saved in the estimation of 20th century civilization. The circumstances were these. George Pitt Rivers of Worcester College, Oxford, wrote a most illuminating brochure entitled The World Significance of the Russian Revolution, which is published and sold for 2 shillings by Basil Blackwell, Oxford. The book is the result of unprejudiced observation and study, and agrees with the statements made in the Dearborn Independent about the personnel of Bolshevism. The manuscript was sent to Dr. Oscar Levy as a representative Jew, and Dr. Levy's letter was subsequently published as a preface to the book. That the reader may understand the tenor of Mr. Pitt River's book, section 16, pages 39 to 41, is herewith given in full, and is followed by Dr. Levy's comments. The italics throughout are intended to remind the reader of remarks on similar lines made in this series.
Although there's no italics in my copy, and probably not in yours either.
Yeah. Well, I have italics.
Oh.
All right. I'll do Pitt Rivers as an Englishman.
Okay.
It is not unnaturally claimed by Western Jews that Russian Jewry, as a whole, is most bitterly opposed to Bolshevism. Now, although there is a great measure of truth in this claim, since the prominent Bolsheviks, who are preponderantly Jewish, do not belong to the Orthodox Jewish Church, it is yet possible, without laying oneself open to the charge of anti-Semitism, to point to the obvious fact that Jewry, as a whole, has consciously or unconsciously worked for and promoted an international economic material despotism, which, with Puritanism as an ally, has tended in an ever-increasing degree to crush national and spiritual values out of existence and substitute the ugly and deadening machinery of finance and factory. It is also a fact that Jewry as a whole strove every nerve to secure and heartily approved of the overthrow of the Russian monarchy, which they regarded as their most formidable obstacle in the path of their ambitions and business pursuits. All this may be admitted, as well as the plea that, individually or collectively, most Jews may heartily detest the Bolshevik regime. Yet it is still true that the whole weight of Jewry was in the revolutionary scales against the Tsar's government. It is true that their apostate brethren, who are now riding in the seat of power, may have exceeded their orders. That is disconcerting, but it does not alter the fact. It may be that the Jews, often the victims of their own idealism, have always been instrumental in bringing about the events they most heartily disapprove of. That, perhaps, is the curse of the wandering Jew.
Now, this sentence, it may be that the Jews, often the victims of their own idealism, etc., is brought up later by this Levy in a way that, to me, is part of his dishonesty or he's actually trying to praise Jews beyond, while at the same time pretending like he's criticizing them. But anyway, this idea, this thing that this Englishman mistakenly said, that it may be that Jews are victims of their own idealism, that it's all about Jewish idealism. Keep that in mind, because that's going to come up later.
Certainly, it is from the Jews themselves that we learn most about the Jews. It is possible that only a Jew can understand a Jew. Nay, more, it may be that only a Jew can save us from the Jews. A Jew who is great enough strong enough, for greater racial purity is a source of strength in the rare and the great, and inspired enough to overcome in himself the life-destructive vices of his own race. It was a Jew who said, quote, "Wars are the Jew's harvest," close quote. But no harvest so rich as civil wars. A Jew reminds us that the French Revolution brought civil emancipation for the Jews in Western Europe. Was it a Jew who inspired Rousseau with the 18th century idea of the sameness of man according to nature? Dr. Callan, a Zionist author, writes, quote, "Suffering for 1,000 years from the assertion of their difference from the rest of mankind, they accepted eagerly the escape from suffering which the 18th century assertion of the sameness of all men opened to them. They threw themselves with passion into the Republican emancipating movements of their fellow subjects of other stocks."
Now, I have to say something here. He says they suffered for 1,000 years from the assertion of their difference from the rest of mankind. Well, but they insisted on their difference from the rest of mankind.
That's true.
You know, it wasn't that people put this on them and caused them to suffer. Here's just an example where this guy, this Englishman, can't think of his name, was being too kindly and too pro-Jewish in his.
He's being approach. A bit credulous there toward the Jew Horace Callan,
yeah.
Taking what he says at face value,
yeah.
Not criticizing and analyzing enough. It was a Jew, Ricardo, who gave us the 19th century ideal of the sameness of man according to machinery. And without the Ricardian gospel of international capitalism, we could not have had the international gospel of Karl Marx. Moses Hess and Disraeli remind us of the particularly conspicuous part played by Jews in the Polish and Hungarian rebellions, and in the Republican uprising in Germany of 1848. Even more conspicuous were they in the new internationalism logically deducible from the philosophy of socialism. This we were taught by the Jew Marx and the Jew Ferdinand LaSalle, but they developed the doctrine of the Jew David Ricardo.
You know, I never heard of David Ricardo.
David Ricardo was an economist who advocated, if I'm recalling correctly, free markets and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I think he was the one who came up with the axiom that private vice amounts to public virtue. In other words, if everybody pursues his own selfish interests, it works out to the benefit of the community, which is not true.
Well, you know, I used to believe that. It's easy,
well,
it's
probably
easy to fall for that. Yeah,
that's mainstream thinking,
yeah,
in the United
right,
States
right.
today.
Exactly, it is. And you can think, well, that works. But anyway, now he's giving this Ricardo guy all kinds of credit.
I'm going to have to check and make sure that he was the one who said that. If I find out that he didn't, I'll make a comment on it on the page.
Okay.
I think he's the one that said that. It was Weininger, a Jew, and also a Jew hater, who explained why so many Jews are naturally communists. Communism is not only an international creed, but it implies the abnegation of real property, especially property in land. And Jews, being international, have never acquired a taste for real property. They prefer money. money is an instrument of power, though eventually, of course, communists claim that they will do away with money. When their power is sufficiently established to enable them to command goods and exercise despotic sway without it. Thus, the same motives prompt the Jew communist and his apparent enemy, the financial Jew. When owners of real property in times of economic depression feel the pinch of straitened circumstances, it is the Jewish usurers who become most affluent, and who, out of goodness of their hearts, come to their assistance at a price. To these and other statements, Dr. Levy, as a Jew, made this reply. Dear Mr. Pitt Rivers, when you first handed me your manuscript on the world significance of the Russian Revolution, you expressed a doubt about the propriety of its title. After a perusal of your work, I can assure you with the best of consciences that your misgivings were entirely without foundation. No better title than The World Significance of the Russian Revolution could have been chosen, for no event in any age will finally have more significance for our world than this one. We are still too near to see clearly this revolution, this portentous event, which was certainly one of the most intimate and therefore least obvious aims of the world conflagration, hidden as it was at first by the fire and smoke of national enthusiasms and patriotic antagonisms. It was certainly very plucky of you to try and throw some light upon an event which necessarily must still be enveloped in mist and mystery. And I was even somewhat anxious lest your audacity in treating such a dangerous subject would end in failure, or what is nearly the same, in ephemeral success. No age is so voracious of its printed offspring as ours. There was thus some reason to fear lest you had offered to this modern Kronos only another mouthful of his accustomed nourishment for his immediate consumption. That's referring to the ancient Greek myth of Kronos preventing his own overthrow by eating all of his children.
Oh, yeah.
I was, I am glad to report, agreeably surprised. Surprised, though not by the many new facts which you give and which must surprise all those who take an interest in current events. Facts, I believe, which you have carefully and personally collected and selected, not only from books but from the lips and letters of Russian eyewitnesses and sufferers, from foes as well as from friends of the Great Revolution. What I appreciate more than this new light thrown on a dark subject, more than the conclusion drawn by you from this wealth of facts, is the psychological insight which you display in detecting the reasons why a movement so extraordinarily bestial and so violently crazy as the revolution was able to succeed and finally to overcome its adversaries. For we are confronted with two questions which need answering and which, in my opinion, you have answered in your pamphlet. These questions are, one, how has the Soviet government, admittedly the government of an insignificant minority, succeeded not only in maintaining but in strengthening its position in Russia after 2.5 years of power? And two, why has the Soviet government, in spite of its outward bestiality and brutal tyranny, succeeded in gaining the sympathies of an increasing number of people in this country?
Well, now we have to intervene here and say that he says, in spite of its bestiality, I'll just say bestiality, because he's talking about being beasts, you know, being like beasts, there's worse that you could say, and brutal tyranny. That is how they succeeded. They used that to succeed. Would you not say so? It's not a mystery.
Well, it's called terrorism.
Yeah, terrorism. That's how they succeeded, and no one could do anything about it. So it's not that they accepted it, but they couldn't do anything about it, and they were murdering people by the thousands. And then why has the government succeeded in gaining sympathy from an increasing number of people? Because of lies that the Jewish people, for one thing, and the American government, for another, and other, you know, things you can name, went along with all these lies to cover up what these Jews in Russia were really up to, and these communists. So this, I don't think this is being put quite accurately. Anyway, that's my comment.
You rightly recognize that there is an ideology behind it, and you clearly diagnose it as an ancient ideology. There is nothing new under the sun. It is even nothing new that this sun rises in the east. 4. Bolshevism is a religion and a faith. How could these half-converted believers ever dream to vanquish the truthful and the faithful of their own creed? These holy crusaders who had gathered round the red standard of the prophet Karl Marx, and who fought under the daring guidance of these experienced officers of all latter-day revolutions, the Jews. I am touching here on a subject which, to judge from your own pamphlet, is perhaps more interesting to you than any other. In this you are right. There is no race in the world more enigmatic, more fatal, and therefore more interesting than the Jews. Now, he's just blatantly bragging there.
Right. More interesting.
As a Jew, he's standing up and saying, we bad, we bad. Basically.
Yeah. Right.
Every writer who, like yourself, is oppressed by the aspect of the present and embarrassed by his anxiety for the future must try to elucidate the Jewish question and its bearing upon our age.
Oh, yes, the Jewish question. He is turning it into that the Jews are the most important people on the planet, and therefore this Jewish question is the most important question.
For the question of the Jews and their influence on the world, past and present, cuts to the very root of all things, and should be discussed by every honest thinker, however bristling with difficulties it is, however complex the subject, as well as the individuals of this race, may be. I couldn't help but roll my eyes there, but it's like an automatic reflex there. For the Jews, as you are aware, are a sensitive community, and thus very suspicious of any Gentile who tries to approach them with a critical mind. They are always inclined, and that on account of their terrible experiences, to denounce anyone who is not with them as against them, as tainted with medieval prejudice, as an intolerant antagonist of their faith and of their race.
See, and now hear this, on account of their terrible experiences. So, no matter how bestial they are, or no matter how awful, how murderous and so on they are in these things that they involve themselves in, they've still gone through these terrible experiences themselves, you know, that he is upholding here.
Nor could or would I deny that there is some evidence, some prima facie evidence, of this antagonistic attitude in your pamphlet. You point out, and with fine indignation,
the great danger that springs from the prevalence of Jews in finance and industry, and from the preponderance of Jews in rebellion and revolution. You reveal with great fervor the connection between the collectivism of the immensely rich international finance, the democracy of cash values, as you call it, and the international collectivism of Karl Marx and Trotsky, the democracy of and by decoy cries. And all this evil and misery, the economic as well as the political, you trace back to one source, one fons et origo malorum, the Jews. Now, other Jews may vilify and crucify you for these outspoken views of yours. I myself shall abstain from joining the chorus of condemnation. I shall try to understand your opinions and your feelings, and having once understood them, as I think I have, I can defend you from the unjust attacks of my often too impetuous race. But first of all, I have to say this. There is scarcely an event in modern Europe that cannot be traced back to the Jews. Take the great war that appears to have come to an end. Ask yourself, what were its causes and its reasons? You will find them in nationalism. You will at once answer that nationalism has nothing to do with the Jews, who, as you have just proved to us, are the inventors of the international idea. But no less than Bolshevist ecstasy and financial tyranny, this is a difficult sentence because of the way it's written. Mm. It's phrased in a way that's like normal in German, but not in English. Let me try this again. But no less than Bolshevist ecstasy and financial tyranny can national bigotry, if I may call it so, be finally followed back to a Jewish source. Are not they the inventors of the chosen people myth? And is not this obsession part and parcel of the political credo of every modern nation, however small and insignificant it may be?
Well, you want to kind of explain that sentence to the listeners a little bit? It's a long one.
Well, I'm not sure which part wasn't clear.
Well, he's saying that
bigotry
can be followed back to a Jewish source.
That the Jews invented nationalism because extreme nationalism because, they claimed to be the chosen people.
Right.
But I think that's an overstatement, probably. I mean.
Oh, yes.
We just have.
They didn't invent nationalism.
Like every Indian tribe in the United States has a lot of them. Their name for themselves in their own language means the human beings. There are a number of them like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know. The other tribes are not human beings.
Right.
You know. And the Romans also had a kind of chosen people myth.
Well, when you're tribal, you have that. That goes along with it.
We're the best. It's called ethnocentrism.
Yeah. But, the rise of internationalism and universalism has made that into something that's not acceptable anymore. But
okay. Yeah. And then think of the history of nationalism. Think of the history of nationalism. It started in our time and as a reaction against Napoleon. Napoleon was the antagonist of the French Revolution. The French Revolution was the consequence of the German Reformation. The German Reformation was based upon a crude Christianity. This kind of Christianity was invented, preached, and propagated by the Jews.
Listen to that.
Four.
Listen to that. This Christianity was invented, preached, and propagated by the Jews. The Reformation, he's saying.
Therefore, the Jews have made this war.
See, I think that's just nuts.
Yes, that was my reaction exactly. This is completely crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You're certainly, when you read that, you're tempted to think that he's mocking the reader or mocking Mr. Pitney Bowes or whatever his name was.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, that really reveals it, this guy, I think. But there's more.
Yeah. Please do not think that this is a joke. It only seems a joke. And behind it, there lurks a gigantic truth. And it is this, that all latter-day ideas and movements have originally sprung from a Jewish source. I had to roll my eyes again. For the simple reason that the Semitic idea has finally conquered and entirely subdued this only apparently irreligious universe of ours.
Yeah, that's really wild.
There is no doubt that the Jews regularly go one better or worse than the Gentile in whatever they do. There is no further doubt that their influence today justifies a very careful scrutiny and cannot possibly be viewed without serious alarm. The great question, however, is whether the Jews are conscious or unconscious malefactors. I myself am firmly convinced that they are unconscious ones. But please do not think that I wish to exonerate them on that account. A conscious evildoer has my respect, for he knows at least what is good. An unconscious one, well, he needs the charity of Christ, a charity which is not mine, to be forgiven for not knowing what he is doing. But there is in my firm conviction not the slightest doubt that these revolutionary Jews do not know what they are doing, that they are more unconscious sinners than voluntary evildoers. I am glad to see that this is not an original observation of mine, but that you yourself have a very strong foreboding about the Jews being the victims of their own theories and principles. On page 39 of your pamphlet, you write, it may be that the Jews have always been instrumental in bringing about the events that they most heartily disapprove of. That maybe is the curse of the wandering Jew, close quote. If I had not the honor as well as the pleasure of knowing you personally, if I were not strongly aware of your passionate desire for light, and your intense loathing of unfairness, this sentence, and this sentence alone, which tells the truth, will absolve you, in my eyes, from the odious charge of being a vulgar anti-Semite.
Now, I think that's really kind of what you'd call, a slimy kind of approach that he's taking here toward this other fellow. If I didn't know you, you know, and know that you blah, 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 I would think that you were just a vulgar anti-Semite. Just the way he words all that, I find it very distasteful.
It has mixed messages in its implications.
There you go.
No, you are not a vulgar. You are a very enlightened critic of our race. For there is an anti-Semitism, I hope and trust, which does the Jews more justice than any blind philo-Semitism, than does that merely sentimental, let them all come liberalism, which in itself is nothing but the Semitic ideology all over again.
and thus you can be just to the Jews without being romantic about them. You have noticed with alarm that the Jewish elements provide the driving forces for both communism and capitalism, for the material as well as the spiritual ruin of this world. But then you have at the same time the profound suspicion that the reason of all this extraordinary behavior may be the intense idealism of the Jew. In this you are perfectly right. The Jew, if caught by an idea, never thinks any more in watertight compartments as do the Teuton and the Anglo-Saxon peoples, whose right cerebral hemisphere never seems to know what its left twin brother is doing. He, the Jew, like the Russian, at once begins to practice what he preaches. He draws the logical conclusion from his tenets. He invariably acts upon his accepted principles. It is from this quality, no doubt, that springs his mysterious force, that force which you no doubt condemn, but which you had to admire even in the Bolshevists. And we must admire it, whether we are Jews or whether we are Christians. For have not these modern Jews remained true to type? Is there no parallel for them in history? Do they not go to the bitter end even in our day?
You know, they're not the only people that go to the bitter end of something at all.
Well, I think what is being discussed there is the tendency for Jews to latch on to an idea which usually, I believe, was not even invented by them. They'll take up some idea that some non-Jew invented, usually a European, and they'll push it to the absolute extremes. They'll treat it as a pure abstraction without any consequence for how pushing it to those extremes affects life. You know, they'll just carry everything to the extreme. And I think this is because they don't have to live with the consequences of what they're doing. You know, it's like, for example, if Jews destroy, you know, or ruin a country through some kind of ideology that goes too far in a particular direction, they could just jump off the ship and hop onto another ship, right?
That's right. That's right.
They don't have to live. They live as a small minority. They don't have to put up with all the consequences of these ideas that they take up and push to the extreme. They can always go somewhere else later on.
But do you think that they're not aware that that's true? That they just do these things and because that's the way they are, and you know that, like he's saying, he's also this insult that sort of that. The Teuton and the Anglo-Saxon think in watertight compartments, you know, but the Jews and the Russians, he says, you know, just put things into practice right away and carry them out. I don't know that that holds water, but otherwise what you said is very true. But do you think that they, he's saying that they're not aware of this. He's saying that they just do it because
in some ways, this business of pushing ideas to their limits is a way of weakening the society in which they live. A good example of that would be the Declaration of Independence. It says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal." Well, in the 1950s and 60s, that was used in order to undermine the power of the white majority in the United States.
It was taken like literally, you know. Became literal.
I don't want to get into the whole history of the Declaration of Independence, but it really was not taken as seriously throughout most of the history of the United States as it is in the past few decades.
Right.
It was not. And, you know, the white people in the United States who actually have to live with the consequences of implementing all men are created equal have a, you know, a kind of an instinctive reaction against doing that. Something in them says, no, don't push that to the limit. You know, but the Jews, they don't care. It's other people that have to live with the consequences of their, you know, of their mental games.
Yeah, that's very good.
All right. Who stirred up the people during the late war in Germany? Who pretended to have, again, the truth? That truth about which Pontius Pilate once shrugged his shoulders. Who pleaded for honesty and cleanliness in politics? That honesty which brings a smile to the lips of any experienced proconsul of today. Writers, who were mostly Jews, Fried, Fernau, or Furneaux, I'm not sure, Latzko, Richard Grelling, the author of J'accuse, who was killed and allowed himself to be killed for these very ideas and principles. Men and women of the Jewish race. Oh, that was a question. Who was killed and allowed himself to be killed for these very ideas and principles? Men and women of the Jewish race. Haase, Levine, Luxemburg, Landauer, Kurt Eisner, the Prime Minister of Bavaria. That was Eisner.
Right.
From Moses to Marx, from Isaiah to Eisner, in practice and in theory, in idealism and in materialism, in philosophy and in politics, they are today what they have always been. Passionately devoted to their aims and to their purposes, and ready, nay, eager, to shed their last drop of blood for the realization of their visions.
Boy. Oh, wow. I think that's funny. It says, "Eyes from Isaiah to Eisner."
Yeah.
What a combination.
Well, Eisner, actually, he was kind of a moderate, really. The Jews that took over after Eisner were the bad ones.
That's true. I've come across that. So,
but these visions are all wrong, you will reply. Look where they have led the world to. Think that they have now had a fair trial of 3,000 years standing. How much longer are you going to recommend them to us and to inflict them upon us? And how do you propose to get us out of the morass into which you have launched us if you do not change the path upon which you have led the world so disastrously astray? To this question, I have only one answer to give, and it is this. You are right. This reproach of yours, which I feel it for certain, is at the bottom of your anti-Semitism, is only too well justified. And upon this common ground, I am quite willing to shake hands with you and defend you against any accusation of promoting race hatred. If you are anti-Semite, I, the Semite, am an anti-Semite too, and a much more fervent one than even you are. We Jews have erred, my friend. We have most grievously erred. And if there was truth in our error 3,000, 2,000, nay, 100 years ago, there is now nothing but falseness and madness, a madness that will produce an even greater misery and an even wider anarchy. I confess it to you openly and sincerely, and with a sorrow whose depth and pain an ancient psalmist and only he could moan into this burning universe of ours. We who have posed as the saviors of the world, we who have even boasted of having given it the savior, we are today nothing else but the world's seducers, its destroyers, its incendiaries, its executioners. We who have promised to lead you to a new heaven, we have finally succeeded in landing you into a new hell. There has been no progress, least of all moral progress. And it is just our morality which has prohibited all real progress, and, what is worse, which even stands in the way of every future and natural reconstruction in this ruined world of ours. I look at this world, and I shudder at its ghastliness. I shudder all the more as I know the spiritual authors of all this ghastliness. But its authors themselves, unconscious in this as in all they are doing, know nothing yet of this startling revelation.
Well, this is what's important here, you know, when he says that it's all unconscious. They're not conscious of what they're doing. We'll have to discuss that at the end.
While Europe is aflame, while its victims scream, while its dogs howl in the conflagration, and while its very smoke descends in darker and even darker shades upon our continent, the Jews, or at least a part of them, and by no means the most unworthy ones, endeavor to escape from the burning building and wish to retire from Europe into Asia, from the somber scene of our disaster into the sunny corner of their Palestine. Their eyes are closed to the miseries. Their ears are deaf to the moanings. Their heart is hardened to the anarchy of Europe. They only feel their own sorrows. They only bewail their own fate. They only sigh under their own burdens. They know nothing of their duty to Europe, which looks around in vain for help and guidance. They know nothing even of their own great ancestor, to whose heart the appeal of pity was never made in vain. They have become too poor in love, too sick at heart, too tired in battle, too tired of battle. And lo, these sons of those who were once the bravest of soldiers are now trying to retire from the trenches to the rear, are now eager to exchange the grim music of the whistling shells with that of the cowbells and vintage songs in the happy plain of Sharon.
Well, let me just stick in here. You know, they are the sons of those who were once the bravest of soldiers. When were they the bravest of soldiers? I guess he's talking about the Old Testament when they had these battles where they slaughtered people who were unprepared.
Which is not authentic history anyway.
No, right. So, but I mean, you know, I mean, what the heck is... Who is he referring to? You know he's referring to Jews, but it's amazing. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, I don't think Jews have ever been, in any historic period, known for being brave soldiers.
No, not at all.
And yet, we are not all financiers. We are not all Bolshevists. We have not all become Zionists. And yet there is hope, great hope, that this same race which has provided the evil, will likewise succeed in supplying its antidote, its remedy, the good. It has always been so in the past. Was not that fatal liberalism, which has finally led to Bolshevism, in the very midst of that dark 19th century, most strenuously opposed by two enlightened Jews? Friedrich Stahl, the founder of the Conservative Party in Germany, and by Benjamin Disraeli, the leader of the Tory Party in England.
But now they were not the only ones who were strenuously opposing this, but he picks out these two Jews and says, oh, you know, these are the, this is where the opposition came from.
Huh. Yeah, I'm sure they were not the only critics of liberalism.
No.
And if these two eminent men had no suspicion yet that their own race and its holy message were at the bottom of that unfortunate upheaval with which their age was confronted, how eager, how determined, how passionate will be the opposition of the Disraelis of the future, once they have clearly recognized that they are really fighting the tenets of their own people, and that it was their good, their love, their ideal that had launched the world into this hell of evil and hatred. A new good as a new love, a true love, an intelligent love. A love that calms and heals and sweetens will then spring up among the great in Israel and overcome that sickly love, that insipid love, that romantic love, which has hitherto poisoned all the strength and all the nobility of this world. For hatred is never overcome by hatred. It is only overcome by love.
And now I'm waiting for the violins to, you know, I hear the violins in the background. This guy's really getting warmed up here, isn't he, Rick?
For hatred is never overcome by hatred. It is only overcome by love. And it wants a new and a gigantic love to subdue that old and devilish hatred of today. That is our task for the future. A task which will, I am sure, not be shirked by Israel. By that same Israel, which has never shirked a task, whether it was for good or whether it was for evil. Of course, Israel at that time just meant the Jews collectively.
That's true.
Yes, there is hope, my friend. For we are still here. Our last word is not yet spoken. Our last deed is not yet done. Our last revolution is not yet made. This last revolution, the revolution that will crown our revolutions, our revolutionaries, will be the revolution against the revolutionaries. It is bound to come. And it is perhaps upon us now. The great day of reckoning is near. It will pass a judgment upon our ancient faith, and it will lay the foundation to a new religion. And when that great day has broken, when the values of death and decay are put into the melting pot to be changed into those of power and beauty, then you, my dear Pitt Rivers, the descendant of an old and distinguished Gentile family, may be assured to find by your side, and as your faithful ally, at least one member of that Jewish race, which has fought with such fatal success upon all the spiritual battlefields of Europe. Yours against the revolution and for life ever flourishing, Oscar Levy, Royal Society's Club, St. James Street, London, Southwest, July 1920.
Ah, wow. Well, now, this guy just doesn't strike one as being very sincere or truthful. Well, what's a better word for it? Authentic.
You think he's being ironic?
Well, I don't think he's being ironic. I think he's being dishonest. And so I really can't say why he would have responded. But this Oscar Levy, he was kind of a character, wasn't he? So, you know, he probably responded to a lot of things. And he was not known to be really on the side of the Jews 100% like some of these Jews. You know, he wasn't one of these total Jews. That was his reputation. Well, unless you want to say something in particular, I wanted to ask kind of why they didn't comment on what he wrote here, but maybe that's coming in the next chapter, and I didn't look ahead to see
next chapter is on money.
Oh, okay.
But, I think Oscar Levy, I think he took some of Nietzsche's ideas and ran with them. I think that's what he did. This idea that the Jewish religion is a problem. You know, because you can get that out of Nietzsche, and you can also get out of some of Nietzsche's books this sort of exaggerated estimation of the importance of the Jews. And you get both of those things here with Oscar Levy. So I think that's where he's coming from on that. The fact that he seems to be giving mixed signals here, I think reflects the fact that that he's a Jew criticizing Jews, and as such, he has not ceased to be a Jew himself. So he's criticizing, but self-flattering at the same time. You know, this is why we shouldn't rely heavily on our interpretations of what to make, you know. We should rely on our own people for interpretations, not Jews. You can get some tidbits of information here and there from Jews, but when they start interpreting things for us, I think we're getting into trouble there.
Well, yeah, I sure don't like his interpretations here. And here, he's talking about, I really resent this. He says up a ways, he's talking about Europe and these the Jews, or some, I guess it's the Jews, their hearts are hardened to the anarchy of Europe. They only feel their own sorrows. They only bewail their own fate. They only sigh under their own burdens. And then he says, they know nothing of their duty to Europe, which looks around in vain for help and guidance.
Yes. Yes. Superman when you need him.
They have no duty to Europe, and get out of Europe. You know, get out of the whole thing. Nobody wants you. This is just way, you know, turning things way around as though they are a part of Europe. And this is what really, this always bothers me more than anything else, whoever it is that talks about it, that makes Jews a part of Europe. Because, you know,
it sounds like certain things that you can find in Nietzsche.
Well, too bad. No wonder I have this. I've read some Nietzsche. It was a long time ago. I don't remember it that well. I wouldn't have known what to make of it in along these lines. Anyway, but yeah, it's no wonder that I don't have a good feeling. I have any desire to study Nietzsche, or I don't even have a good feeling for him.
Yeah, well, see, Nietzsche went through three phases. He started out being a disciple of Wagner. That's when he wrote The Birth of Tragedy from the Spirit of Music. Then he went through a middle period where he was saying good things about Jews all the time. And then in his last years, he wrote things like The Antichrist and Toward a Genealogy of Morals, where he was blaming Jews for moral decay and Christianity in particular.
Yeah. Well, so this was, you know, this is a very interesting chapter, because it's very interesting to see how this guy talks. You know, all the things that he says, you would really, sharpens you up for talking with the Jew who would talk like this, you know, and seeing what's behind it. Well, we have actually run out of time, so we'll say goodnight, everyone, and tune in next week.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.